Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. Oh, we are going solo today. It wasn't my intention. I was actually going to share an episode with Lucy Sheridan with you. But that's going to have to hit pause because this stuff, I mean, if you're hearing about this for the first time, again, I want you to hit Google and ask yourself why you're hearing this for the first time. So yesterday, two things happened, namely in America, and one involving somebody called Amy Cooper, who was recorded lying on camera, stating that a black man in a park was threatening her and harming her dog when she was asked by him in a polite manner to put the dog on the leash, as were the terms of Central Park. All dogs in Central Park need to be on leash. There's a leash law. And she didn't like being told by a black man. And what ensued was her approaching him in threatening behaviour. And if you're really that intrigued and you haven't seen this, by all means, go on over to my Instagram to watch this little theatrical performance. And when he didn't stop recording and when he didn't back down from her threats and he told her to step back and remain away from him, she then said, "I'm going to call the cops. I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life." And she did. And what followed was a theatrical performance of her lying on camera, stating that he was doing things to her that he wasn't, including harming her dog. The irony was that she was so riled up, she ended up strangling her dog, who was yelping and weeping while she was so enraged by this man. And then she started crying on the phone, saying, "Come quick, come quick." It's the most profound thing. And what I spoke about it on social media, but what in isolation, what's then followed is a load of mainstream news outlets reporting on the fact that she's apologised and she's not racist and she didn't mean it. You have to be absolutely calculated to know that if you lie and call the police and tell them that a black man is doing something that they're not, as a white woman, that you're going to be believed over them. This is an age-old trick that's been used in the book by white women, and I go into this in great detail on my anti-racism course because it's profoundly important about the role that white women had during the height of the transatlantic slave trade, around a time when women were oppressed because of their gender by men. They had no access to wealth, they had very few rights. Granted, they had more rights than people that were enslaved, but they had less rights than men. And so women's vehicle to wealth, women's vehicle to control, was to very much being control of black bodies, being control of who they enslaved, their property. And there are so many sadistic and violent accounts of what women would do to vent their frustrations about their own oppression in inhumane ways. There was one story of and actually, I need to preface this because if you are black, then you might find some of what I'm going to share troubling. So maintain your own well-being and decide if you want to sit through what I'm going to talk about or not, because I am going to talk about some of the violence that was put upon our bodies. So the first story I want to share is of a little girl called Henrietta King, and she was only 8 or 9 at the time, and her slave owner, she was in the house with the family, and she had stolen some sweets, as young little 8 or 9 year olds do. She was playing along with her playmate, who was a white girl at that time. You know, they're probably only just starting to see that there is a difference between the way that they are treated with the way their parents treat them with white skin and those who are their property. But they were still playing, and little Henrietta had stole some sweets, and the mistress, her punishment for this little 8-year-old girl stealing sweets was to beat her and proceed to put her rocking chair on her head and rock back and forth for an hour. This was an 8-year-old girl. This resulted in little Henrietta being in a coma, and miraculously Henrietta survived that brutality, physically anyway. And she was so traumatized, and it was so violent that she was completely mutilated and was no longer able to chew. These were just some of the accounts of what white women did to black people in the height of slavery. There was this picture painted that they were sort of damsels in distress, women who were oppressed by men, and that, you know, they had nothing to do with any of the brutality and any of the sadistic ways really that went on. And that's simply not true. If you're interested in reading up on this, then one book that accounts, real accounts from people who survived being enslaved, is called They Were Her Property by Stephanie E. Rogers. You can have that one on me. I talk about this in great detail on my anti-racism course, because we need to understand the history of what went on between white women and black women. There is so much more. I'm not going into it on the podcast. You need to invest in this work and engage in it and do it properly. One of which is lying, and I talk about white fragility, and white fragility can show up in many ways: defensiveness, denial, anger, aggression, and this one in particular, lying. This one happens a lot, and crying. You may hear statements like white women tears floating around the internet, and that's another way, tears being used as a tool to manipulate and control a circumstance. Again, not always conscious, but a lot of the time it is. And with Amy Cooper, this was one of those times when that was a conscious method with which to manipulate and control the outcome. And what I haven't mentioned about Amy Cooper is that she was in a managerial position, I believe, vice president of a corporation. And if you imagine that this person is out there quite happily exposing their racism and revealing some very dark parts of themselves, imagine what it's like to be managed under that. This is why I do the work that I do. I'm jumping around a little bit, but this is why I do the work that I do, because the most dangerous type of racism that we deal with in the West, I believe, and it's not to say the overt acts aren't dangerous, they are, but they happen far less frequently than these everyday occurrences, as demonstrated by the theatrical performance by Amy Cooper this week. They are more dangerous than overt acts of hate because they happen so regularly and they are unaddressed. If you've got somebody who has those views and is hidden, and they've been able to morph and assimilate and make their way up to organisations in roles of power, in roles where they have power over somebody and influence over somebody's progression, that might go some way to explain why there is a disproportionate amount of people in the black community who experience higher rates of mental ill health. And I'm giving you some examples in America, and we'll move on to Britain in a minute, because I know there are some people who like to think that we're better, and we are. Make no mistake, we are not. In fact, if you're following this podcast, you probably already know that, so I'm preaching to the converted. So in terms of white fragility and lying, this you know, white fragility can show up as lying, as demonstrated in this clip by Amy Cooper. And this is something that happens very regularly. I've had it happen to me. I've had, if not the lion, the tears, or both, as a way in which to place themselves as the victim, so that either your behaviour changes, you soften, or you toe the line. or that you just want power over somebody, you know, to be really, really frank, that, you know, there are some people who have sadistic tendencies in their personality, and, you know, that what that's driven by, who knows. But a famous case is the one of Carolyn Bryant and Emmett Till. So Carolyn Bryant accused Emmett Till, who I believe was 13 or 14 years old at the time, of an out shopping for his family. He's gone to the local shops to pick up some essential items, and accused him of sexually harassing her. This is a 13-year-old black boy in 1959 in America. Not really sure anyone's going to be that emboldened at that time to do anything as that, but that's what she claimed. And she went back to her husband and told him that this little boy had done these things to her. Her husband then gathered his mates and they went and found Emmett in his bed whilst he was asleep, dragged him out, beat him and lynched him. And again, there was so much brutality that he didn't look human. And his mother, Mammy Till, was so heartbroken, as you can imagine, by this violent attack on her little boy, who is simply being who he cannot help but be, and coming sadly into paths with this woman. And she left, she at the funeral, she wanted an open casket. She wanted people to see what they had done to him. She was never charged, and she was on her deathbed a few years ago. Carolyn lived a long life, and she was on her deathbed a few years ago and finally admitted that she lied. So when we see behaviour exhibited from white women like Amy Cooper lying, when we see behaviour like tears, crying wolf, it not only undermines those people who are actually in need of help when they are in trouble, but it is in connective tissue in lineage as a method with which to manipulate and control outcomes. It's awful. It's absolutely abhorrent. Understanding this and the historical context of this tool, this type of white fragility that still manifests today in people lying, in white women crying when an issue about injustice or racism is brought up, to center themselves in the conversation. This is why this is so harmful, and why you might hear many activists talking about white women tears being an act of violence. That's what they're talking about. Because historically we know if white women cry, if white women pick up the phone and call the police, especially if you're in America, there is a high chance that you may well die. You may well lose your life if you're a black man. Because they know, historically, history shows them that if I lie and make up a story about this black man, then I'm going to be believed because I'm a white woman. That's consciously using privilege to manipulate an outcome. That is the type of stuff that is more dangerous than another act of hate. In a cruel irony of this video surfacing of Amy, what also happened yesterday was another violent attack, police brutality, on a young man called George Floyd. I was out working in the garden yesterday. My husband came to me and he looked really distressed. And I said, "Are you all right?" And he said, "Have you seen this? Just go on this page." And I was like, "Oh gosh, I'm not sure if I can. And so I scrolled onto a Sean King, who was a huge activist, over a million followers, does a lot of campaigning around police brutality and unlawful, everything, you know, just murders and police caused by police brutality and other injustices to people of colour that centres on the American experience, but he has international reach. And Sean King does impeccable campaigning, but he also is... He doesn't sugarcoat his work. He will show the videos, and I can't, that's something I cannot do. It's not good for my mental health. I cannot watch videos of black bodies being brutalized. Can't do it. But my husband saw it and it just shook him. And so I said, give me the headlines. And so I then started digging around and doing my own research. A black man called George Floyd, a peaceful man who I'm hearing about, Christian man who the police lied and claimed, here we go, white fragility again, I must use the race, four policemen are white, lied and claimed that he wasn't cooperating. Further footage put forward by a restaurant owner in the area of where this murder happened, submitted footage to the police and said this man was fully, I heard and I saw, and his camera evidence from my shop CCTV that shows he was in full cooperation. So they lied to cover up their stories that the man didn't cooperate. And they had him handcuffed and they had him on the ground laying down, and one police officer was using brute force and had his knee on his neck, so much so that he had his knee on his neck for 5 minutes until he stopped breathing and died. This happened yesterday. So you've got, on the one hand, Amy Cooper calling the police on an African-American man in a park because she knows that if the police come, they're more likely to believe her and could cause that man some harm. And at the same time, in some bizarre synchronicity, another black man dying under the hands of police brutality. And I know some of you will be listening to this and thinking, this is America, this doesn't happen here. Everything is linked. Everything in our complex history is linked. Let me give some reframes in the context of what's going on here in the UK. Okay, let me go back to history. I'm brushing up on my history at the moment, and these stats are just in my head. So in 1959, when Emmett Till was murdered, there was also, and this was in America, there was also the murder of somebody in Notting Hill, London, a young 32-year-old man called Kelso Chochrane, Chochrane. So we always think that these things are happening elsewhere. They're happening here. What we're great at doing in Britain is covering things up and hiding in plain sight, just doing stuff under the radar. So yesterday, I, again, as an anti-racism educator, I always get sent, you know, the reality of what is going on in terms of racism. And I was sent an article about the number of black people who are being arrested under these new COVID laws here in the UK. I should preface, not necessarily arrested, but certainly issued fines. And even though people in the black, Asian and minority ethnic community make up just 15.5% of the population, they've been issued 22.2% of the fines. And this was something that people were really concerned about in the black community, because black men are already 10 times more likely to be stopped and searched than white men for simply being who they cannot help but be. And this stuff, I'm trying to link it to you so you understand a bit more, all comes back down from something called sus laws. So when slavery was abolished, something called sus laws were introduced. And that meant that they could arrest people. The police had the powers to arrest people on suspicion that they might commit a crime. So if you've been demonising a collective of people over hundreds and hundreds of years, where do you think your suspicion is going to lie? It's certainly not going to lie in the white majority. That stuff is still rotten to the core and impacting the disproportionate amounts of people who are arrested, who are imprisoned, and who are treated like criminals. And that happens here in the UK and clearly in the US as well. Everything has a knock-on effect. I've been reading up on the incredible author and activist James Baldwin. In fact, not just him, also Malcolm X and Martin Luther King recently on a Black History course I'm doing, because this stuff, there's so much we can learn, we never know it all, including myself, and the more I know, the more I can help you. And so it's actually it's nourishing on one hand and painfully frustrating on the other, that we seem to be making such little steps forward. But I was reading up on James Baldwin, and I just want to read you something that he said in one of his speeches. And if you don't know who James Baldwin is, oh boy, hit Google. He said, "You cannot lynch me and keep me in ghettos without becoming something monstrous yourselves." I'll just preface this. James Baldwin noted in many of his essays and in his writing that he feared, he had a great fear and a great hatred of white people. And he used to refer to white people as moral monsters. And so let me just read this to you with that context there. "You cannot lynch me and keep me in ghettos without becoming something monstrous yourselves. And furthermore, you give me a terrifying advantage. You never had to look at me. I had to look at you. And I know more about you than you know about me." He's talking about specifically the way in which black people were treated and murdered and lynched. And there's images in the archives of groups of white people in that time congregating to watch, and the person being killed, and with a human being killed, would often have a sack or something over their head, or you would see images of white people turning their backs and not looking. And so when he speaks about this, I think that that's what he's referencing. "You give me a terrifying advantage. You never had to look at me. I had to look at you, and I knew more about you than you know about me." And I think there's an element of that also within how we have, as black people, have learned and have been made to mold and bend and assimilate, to have limited representation and positive representation of people like us on TV and books, and how that starts to view, how that starts to form how you view yourself and how you view your own community, and how that can turn into internalized racism, which James Baldwin had a huge amount of self-hate for growing up in these conditions, many of which lots of us will be able to resonate with, because this stuff, the power of white supremacy, can seep in to your self-esteem and your very essence of who you are. And if you're seeing such hatred being projected by other people onto you and to your community and people that look like you, how do you think that that can manifest and morph and mutate within yourself? This stuff runs deep. Anyway, he goes on, and this is the part I really want to just let land with you. "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. History is not the past, it is the present. We carry our history with us. We are our history. If we pretend otherwise, we literally are criminals." I can't think of anything more accurate than that right now. It's deeply speaking to me. I'm talking about these instances that are happening in America and happening here in the UK. I'm talking about the fact that we see these marches and these civil rights movements about making Black Lives Matter, and still having these issues with lying and manipulation and control over our bodies taking place today. We have reports in the UK that Black people in particular are 4 times more likely to die from CV19, and it has not been mentioned or addressed by a British government. Not surprised, because this is a government that historically has racist ideologies within its core, had slogans in the 60s where they used, if you want a nigger for a neighbour, vote Labour. This is who is running our country. They didn't care about people before a pandemic. They didn't care about the, you know, great swathes of society who are marginalised before. If there was a human rights infringement inflicted by our government. They were so they treated the disabled community so appallingly over a 6 to 7 year period. There was a human rights infringement on them, and yet the great British public still favoured and voted them in. That's the part I can't get my head round. This stuff is available and in plain sight. So it's no surprise to me, but I'm just showing you the little drops of how it is communicated that some lives have more value than others. Because if it was, the stats were showing that that white people were four times more likely to die from CV19, then you can bet that there would be an investigation. You can bet that this would be on front page news. If our media wasn't biased, you can bet that the headlines would be talking about why Amy's behaviour and sort of unpicking why Amy's behaviour was problematic and racist, rather than she's apologised, thinking that apologising just because you've had your racism exposed and the stakes have got higher and you've lost your job is atonement. It's not atonement. Taking action and unlearning your racism is atonement. And it goes back to that quote by Mr. Baldwin, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced, and we don't face our bullshit. That's why my role is relevant. Because we don't face it, we don't talk about it, and we definitely don't take action. I've been doing some work. So I'm working with a therapist at the moment, and it's coming at the right time because I'm feeling the magnitude of constantly seeing these stats in the press that our lives matter less, constantly hearing retorts about, when people are starting to think about how they're going to protect their black and brown staff when we go back into the office, when we start to integrate, or even those who are having to be in workplaces now, what organisations are going to do to start to protect them and treat us as a vulnerable group. People moaning, saying, well, why are they getting special treatment? Just let me reframe this for you. Pregnant women are also somebody who were highlighted as a vulnerable group in terms of CV19. Can you imagine the same outcries when measures would be put in place to protect pregnant women? Whenever whiteness is not centred, whenever there is a shift in power, yeah, and it's often not imaginary, there is a resistance, there is a denial, there is a reaction, lying, crying. Yes, but all lives matter. All of this stuff is coming from the same place of not wanting to lose that power. And nobody's going to, you know, not many white people will admit that. That's what's going on. You've become accustomed. What we don't talk about in terms of racism or in terms of slavery is that in order for racism to exist, in order for slavery to exist and to form the infrastructure and to be a commodity and to bring financial wealth and generational wealth to so many families and people still living and benefiting from that, including the royal family, in order for that to exist, in order for people to be systemically disadvantaged, to be treated as less superior, to be dehumanised, to be subhuman. There was a group of people who were systemically advantaged, who were treated as superior. And that's white people, and that's the component we don't talk about. That's going to have a byproduct in how we behave and how we resist change. Oh, I don't actually know where this episode is going. I do this. I just come on and I just, you know, I speak from the heart. And I know that some of this is going to be hard to hear, but I need you to wake up and do the work. I don't know how many more of these atrocities need to happen for people to be motivated into action. I really don't. I was thinking deep in thought. So I'm doing some work with a therapist at the moment. And she said to me, Nova, why? You're an activist. Why don't you use that word? And it was a really, it came, you know, came out of nowhere. And I was like, a little bit of imposter syndrome. Because when I hear the word activist, I think of Martin Luther King. I think of Malcolm X. I think of Angela Davis. I think of Nina Simone. And most people may not know, you know, she was an activist. I think of James Baldwin. I think of Angela Scott. Don't think of me. And she said, no, but look up the definition of activist and then let's talk about this more. So, where is it? Let me give you the black and white definition of activist, because up until this conversation, I never really looked it up. An activist is simply a person who campaigns to bring about political or social change. I was just, you know, digging into this history and the relationship between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and, you know, how their work influenced what we do over here and civil rights movements that were happening in synchronicity in the UK, including James Baldwin, you know, being paid to come to the UK and give talks to help black people living in the UK learn how to navigate this stuff, because it was just, you know, it was horrendous. And, you know, there were so many things we don't know about the UK, including that, you know, a huge organisation like Black Panthers, we automatically assume that's US. They were in the UK as well. Anyway, in digging around and just refreshing my memory on some of the links between civil rights movement in America and in the UK, and key figures who I must say were often black women, who you often don't know about because our work is erased. I'll talk about that in another podcast episode. But the thing that I had forgotten, I see Martin Luther King and Malcolm X as these enormous, great, powerful men who, you know, died serving their cause, and that they, in my mind, had lived these long lives. Both men. They were murdered within 3 years of each other. Malcolm X, 1965. Martin Luther King, 1968. What they shared in common, apart from their movement for social change and to end racism and to get equality, they were 39 years old. I'm 39 years old in a few months' time. One, and then I realised one of the reasons why I've been rejecting using the word activists and being frightened of it is because so many people who are activists die young. I have no plans to die young. I am going to live a long and healthy life. But I realised that I was scared of claiming it because I'm frightened of the impact of what happens when you fully claim it. There was also the imposter syndrome stuff going on as well. Well, I'm, you know, I'm certainly not comparing myself to these great people, but what I am doing, what I am, is a person who campaigns to bring about political or social change. And what I am doing is gathering you and inspiring you and motivating you to be part of that change. Because for too long, we have been silent bystanders. Bystanders. For too long, we have felt that we have no power. Individually we do, and collectively we have even more power. But we've got to have the courage to interrogate. We have got to have the courage to hold people accountable. We have got to have the courage to have difficult conversations in our industries, in our workplaces. For those of you who are working in healthcare who listen to this, what are you doing to ask management what they are doing to safeguard their BAME staff? Not just from more exposure and more detrimental impact to CV19, but the stuff that's going on beneath the surface in your workplace. The staff that are complaining that trying to safeguard us is unfavourable treatment to them. The staff that are complaining about the fact that there is no BAME network for white people. The managers that are putting four black people, No, let me rephrase that. The managers that are putting a black person on a COVID ward with four patients with COVID, and the manager who is putting a white nurse on a non-COVID ward with one patient. So that's 4-1. We all know in terms of CV19 that the more exposure to the virus, the more viral load you get and the worse that you get the disease. Why are managers making that biased decision? Put pressure. What are you doing to start prioritising anti-racism work within the culture of your organisation? Because as we've just seen, demonstrated so beautifully, and if you haven't, please go away and look at the video. It's quite a performance. The theatrical performance of Amy Cooper, a manager, a vice president. This is the racism that I'm talking about. This is the racism that my activism, my campaigning, my work is speaking to, because this is the stuff that seeps into every single industry. HR, the police force. I have so many stories to share. I have another one. Working with a client towards the end of last year, and I was ringing up I can't remember the name of the organisation, probably a good thing right now. But they are an organisation that deals with employee, HR and employee rights in the UK. And they're not the usual organisation that I go to. Usual organisation I go to is ACAS, but for some reason someone had recommended I go to this other one, and I can't remember why. And I was inquiring about something with them in terms of just making sure an advert was lawful, an advert that wanted to use positive action in the Equalities Act. So positive action is where there is a specific group of people, they may or may not be underrepresented, or it may mean that you need to center only employing women for a certain role. For example, if you're working in a crisis center with women refugees, and there's going to be sensitivity around them having experienced violence from men. So you might only want to employ women to work within that organisation for those reasons. Or there was a company that dealt with loneliness in older men, and their charity was providing companionship for older men to have, you know, conversations about mental health and other things with other men. So you might only want to employ men for that role. There are also, in terms of the positive action in the Equality Act, it is highly encouraged that if organisations do not have race equity, are not diverse, and need to improve representation so that the organisation is more representative of the customers of the community and the world around them, that you want to employ people in the BAME community. And I was just checking something, because I worked in equality many years ago in the Equalities Act. So I was just checking my knowledge was up to date, and I went to this organisation just to sense check something. And I was speaking to who I presume to be a white woman on the phone. And she got absolutely, bear in mind, she's working for an organisation that gives advice on HR matters. Impartial advice, it's supposed to be. She was raging that I had the audacity to even suggest that a project should be specific to people in the BAME community. She told me so. She was raging. That's not right. It should go to the best person for the job. And she went off on one. And I'm like, wow. And she's working for an organisation that's supposed to be giving impartial advice. And she doesn't even know the law. She doesn't even know what positive action under the Equalities Act is and what it's meant to use for to improve equity. She's no idea. And she's there working without venom. So this is the work that I do. This is so important, because this type of racism is in the fabric of every single industry. It's in our homes. It's within us too. And unless people have consciously taken steps to unlearn their racism, and I'll go back to that James Baldwin quote, if I can find it, my pages have shifted. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. and we need to face it. We need to have the courage to look at the parts of us that do not make us feel good, to sit in that discomfort. To sit in the shame, to sit in the guilt, to sit in the horror. This work isn't pretty, it's not supposed to be. But on the other side of it, when I see people leaning in and doing this work properly, on the other side of it is absolutely incredible. And if more people realise the influence and the power that they have to be part of change, the further along we'd be, the less atrocities we would have, the more campaigning there would be in workplaces, in government, on the streets, the more calling in there would be, the less Amy Coopers there would be. Before I wrap up, I just want to read something. I got a really beautiful and long email from a person who's recently completed my anti-racism course, and they are a teacher. So they are somebody who has huge influence. They are teaching the next generation. And let me tell you, there's a whole load of white fragility that goes on in teaching in schools. And I just want to share this with you. I just want to leave this with you to show you what happens when people do this work and they lean in and they do it properly. The capacity for change and the ripple effect that that has in a relatively short period of time, there are no words great enough to tell you how incredible this work is when you do it properly. When you ditch the apathy, when you lean in, when you remove your ego, when you strip back the layers. It's incredible. I just need you to believe that it's possible, because at times like this, it can feel like it's not. It is absolutely possible, but you have to do the work. I can't make you not racist. You have to do the work yourself. This is what happens when white women do the work. I've sat down a number of times to write about your anti-racism course and the impact, and I have no words. Words cannot explain the way this work has been a part of a shift to the essence of my very being, of the I am, that all life shares beyond form. I am also aware of the barriers that remain, the conditioning yet to deconstruct. I am being patient with myself, as this idea of ticking a box to say it's done was one way white supremacy showed up in a very problematic way for me. So I'm honouring my process whilst keeping myself in check. I am more vocal. I have lost people in my life, and I'm living in the discomfort of it all, remaining conscious of it all. The more I need to do and the little that I know. But on the other side of the discomfort is the joy. The joy in my life being richer with the experience of others. Of being a white person that black and brown people visibly relax when they can see I'm doing the work. Where they can talk freely and call me out and tell me that something I said was racist. And for me to hear that, acknowledge that, apologise for my harm and to sit with that. And to also laugh at myself and my people and know what I am. I am the good and the bad, and the peace that comes with that, the joy of just being. The process has been intense and I am in awe of it. The healing is real and the layers are mind-blowing. I can't wait to dive back in and do the course again, because I'm sure there'll be even more layers to uncover. Thank you for everything and the awareness, Nova. Awareness is the agent of change. And that's from Amy, one of my anti-racism students. Awareness is the agent of change. That's what happens when people do the work. That's what's possible. I need you to believe that it's possible. And I need you to rise up and do the work. Because change is possible. We just have to do it, and it's going to get uncomfortable.
but we need to learn to sit with it. And we need to do a hell of a lot bloody better. So, all that to say, if these words are resonating with you and speaking with you, I implore you, go on my website, look at my anti-racism course, make the decision and start your anti-racism journey today. What are you waiting for? All that to say, so going back to this activism piece, I've been really sitting with this and finally feel in a place where I can say this. I'm a person who campaigns to bring about social change. And that's just one testimony of how this is working. This stuff is working. My name is Nova Reed, and I'm an activist. It's time for you to rise up and be the change.